can be taken. But I think that the first reaction on all parties that we look for solutions to move forward is positive. And the reaction of the Colombian people has also been very important. There was a huge marches in Bogota and throughout Colombia yesterday, the day before yesterday, that demanded that the process continue. So we all hope that this news of the Nobel Peace Prize can help to move things in the right direction.
And in about a minute that we have left, your reaction to President Santos receiving the award, but not the leader of the FARC?
Well, I was a bit surprised. I think that there's no doubt that President Santos has had a huge role. His perseverance, his dedication is very important and merits the recognition. But I also think that it's important to recognize the decision on the part of the FARC. Their role in all of this has been very, very important from the beginning. And their reaction, in fact, to the defeat of the referendum has also, in my view, been very important. They've stated over and over again that they do not want to return to war, that they are committed to peace. So I think it would have been better, in my view, if the award had been granted to both President Santos and to Rodrigo Londoño, the head of the FARC. Mm.
And finally, less than half of the population voted. What was it, maybe 40%? What is your sense if more people had been involved?
Well, it's hard to say, but I think that there's in very specific issues that you can look at. The fact is that the Hurricane Matthew that is now hitting the coast of the United States was just beginning in the Caribbean, and the day of the vote, the whole northern coast of Colombia was swamped by rain. And so the voter turnout was the lowest precisely on the Atlantic coast. Well, that area voted overwhelmingly for the yes. But if the voter turnout had been just the same degree that it had been throughout the country, maybe the vote would have been different.
Daniel Garcia Pena, we want to thank you for being with us, Colombia's High Commissioner for Peace from 1995 to 98, professor of political science at National University in Bogota, and founder of Planet Peace. That does it for our show. Again, a note about Sunday night, the night of the second debate. It will be a town hall. We will be broadcasting from 8 Eastern Standard Time until 11:30, a roundtable discussion. Then we'll break the sound barrier by having Jill Stein answer the same questions put to the major party candidates. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:02. Up next, Positively Revolting.
Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Please consider applying to become a KBOO board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a current KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm/2016 Board of Directors. Or stop by the station and pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is October 15th. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Space is the Place, showing Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. Space is the Place is an Afrofuturist science fiction classic film released in 1974. Sun Ra, space age prophet, philosopher and Afrojazz bandleader, lands his spaceship in Oakland, expanding the cosmic consciousness of African Americans. Again, that's Space is the Place, Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of your homepage under Community Events. Thank you.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Good morning, good morning. It's about 5 minutes after 8 in the morning. You're tuned to your very own community radio station, KBOO, and this is Positively Revolting. I'm your host, Ani, and Lynn is still ill this week. Good thoughts for Lynn, if you would. And I am, however, joined. Teresa has thrown herself into the mix, host of Press Watch. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
And I thank you for joining us this morning. And as we turn our attention to gun violence in some American culture as seen through the eyes of a foreign journalist, joining us today is Gary Young. Gary is an Alfred Nobler Fellow at the Nation Institute. He's an award-winning columnist for The Guardian and The Nation and is an acclaimed author. He has written several books, won many awards. I'll go ahead and skip to the chase. His most recent book is Another Day in the Death of America, a chronicle of 10 short lives. His previous books include The Speech, The Story Behind Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Dream, as well as Who We Are and Should It Matter in the 21st Century, Stranger in a Strange Land, Encounters in the Disunited States, and No Place Like Home, A Black Britain's Journey Through the American South. Gary, thank you so very much for joining us today in studio.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm excited to have you in this conversation because, you know, when we are looking at things that are ubiquitous in our society, it's like, are fish aware of the water they swim in, right? Mm. And so we as Americans are absolutely inundated with statistics about gun violence and gun culture. We are absolutely inundated with these horrific numbers. And, you know, almost 100 people a day killed by gun violence. Of those, on average, you know, 7 to 9 of them being children, depending what you're looking at. Mass shootings, depending on how we define them, you know, more than one a day, or, you know, again, depending on definitions. And so when we have all these numbers running around, it creates a numbness. And I think that maybe that's the best place to start our story, because you've gone beyond those numbers and you've actually managed to bring out stories of the people killed.
So that was the plan, yeah. So, I mean, every day on average at the moment, 7 children and teens are killed by guns. And the premise of the book is very simple. Find out pick a day at random, find out who they are, and tell their stories. So I spent 18 months, I was a correspondent for The Guardian here for 12 years, and I've only just returned to Britain. And so to some extent, I have a foot in and out of the country. My partner is African-American. I have two kids, two American kids, who now we've gone back to England. You know, it's soccer, Dad. It's not football, it's soccer. So the challenge was in 18 months to find anybody who knew these children, their parents, their caregivers, teachers, preachers, basketball coaches, friends. On the day that I chose, which was the 23rd of November 2013, on average it's 7 children. On that day there were 10. On an average day of those 7 children, 3 would be black, 3 would be white, 1 would be Latino, with an Asian American, Native American, or Pacific Islander rotated in every 3 days, and 2 would be female. On the day I chose, of the 10, 7 were black, 2 Latino, 1 white, and they were all boys. And I know that I didn't get all of them. I didn't get all of the kids who died that day. There were 10 that day, but suicides. On an average day, 2 of the 7 will be suicides. But suicides aren't reported. It's very difficult to find out in a timely manner if someone, if at all, if someone has committed suicide. So I, so there are no suicides in this.
So that would give evidence that, that the number's actually higher. And yet,
on that day. Yeah.
And we actually, I mean, I mentioned about the mass shootings, that really all of it depends on so much, so heavily on definitions.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even in this book, and, you know, I say children and teens, the youngest is 9, the oldest is 19. There are some people who say, well, they're not kids. You know, the 18 and 19-year-olds, they're not minors. I mean, if you read their autopsy reports and about the, you know, their peach fuzz, and, you know, to me, they're kids. But
well, they can't drink yet.
That's,
I mean,
true.
You know,
that's true. Yeah.
Oh, I guess if you're 19, you've been allowed to vote for a year.
Yeah.
But that, you know, by most definitions, it's still youth.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where certainly most adults who would do those who would make that criticism, if you turn to their child who was 19 and probably a sophomore or something, they would understand them as being maturing, but not old. But in any case, and even within this book, the definition of a day, I mean, in America, I actually choose a 24-hour period, so it starts at 3 o'clock in the morning one day and ends at the same time the next day. An American day is actually 29 hours long, because it goes from New York to Hawaii.
Oh, right.
And then of that, the definition of who is included. So I chose to define it as anyone who was shot and died within that 24-hour period. So one boy was shot the day before but died in that day. He's in the book. But there are two kids who were shot that day and died 2 days later or a day later. They're not in the book. And so you're kind of trying to draw these lines, which is partly about protecting the integrity of the book, but also just about saying, let's just be clear what we're talking about here, because it, I mean, in the one of the problems, and we see this, I think, with Donald Trump, we saw it with Brexit, we saw it with Iraq, is if you're not going to agree on some basic facts, it's very difficult to have any kind of discussion.
Right, the framing is pretty important to be upfront about. And the fact that you've just taken this 24-hour period and encapsulated it is a way to make what is an overwhelming issue, you know, into one bite-sized snapshot.
Yeah, it's to, in the introduction, I say it's about putting a human face, a child's face, on the collateral damage of gun violence, that mass shootings episodically get press attention. Most of them don't, but a few.
No, the biggest, the biggest, yeah. Splashiest.
The biggest, yeah. And the ones that are the of the spectacle.
Exactly.
Making. And then recently, episodically, police shootings, if caught on video, might get press attention. Although, once again, most of them don't. And, the bar for getting press attention is actually quite high. Most of these shootings get very little press attention. Of the 10, there are a couple where the circumstances are quite extraordinary, and they get some more. And then there are... the boy who gets shot dead in Dallas gets just around 90 words, 80 words, and that's it. And one of the issues I look at in the book is, how can that be? How can a child be removed from the planet and be effectively a news in brief? And when you talk to the journalists who write these stories, I mean, that was the shortest. But for the most part, what you get is a crime scene piece with a quote from someone who knew the kid, maybe their dad, mum, maybe not. And then that's it. I mean, there's never any follow-up. There's no profile or anything like that. And time and again, the journalists would say, did you think of following it up? Or did you, do you know what happened with the investigation? They say it's just not that surprising that a kid down there, which is nearly always low-income areas of colour, it's not so surprising that the kid will get shot down there. And so I end up concluding that clearly there are places in America where you're not supposed to be shot. Malls, right. Schools, movie theatres. And then there are places where it's not that you're supposed to be shot, but that if a child is shot dead, it doesn't actually challenge America's understanding of how the country works. It just confirms it, really. Well, that's what happens to people down there, and
it's a way of othering and distancing oneself from the horrific violence that is rife in our society,
and making it, I call it a banal fact of death. This is the kind of moral threshold that's set. And journalists, one is taught that adage when you're training that, dog bites man is a story. That's the phrase, gendered as it is. Man bites dog is not a story. And these become dog bites man stories because people always get,
right.
And I think, sooner or later, actually it becomes a journalistic imperative to ask, who owns these dogs? And why do the same people keep being bitten? And that, in a sense, the acceptable is unacceptable, but people have factored it in. It's the kind of white noise that people are prepared to live with.
We're inured to it in so many ways. And that's why I really appreciate your perspective as somebody who was born in England, where there's not... let's talk a little compare and contrast with gun violence in the UK.
Yeah, they're really... there's nothing much to
compare. Pretty negligible.
With. Yeah, I think the last stats I saw, there's about 55 people shot dead in Britain in a year. Everybody. And those would mostly be adults. The police don't carry guns for the most part. So, and it's one of those things where, in the absence of guns, then people don't feel the need to have a gun. And so the notion of, why haven't you got a gun, it's a bit like cell phones. There comes a point at which everybody's got a cell phone because, how the hell am I going to get hold of you if you don't have a cell phone? But there actually has to be a critical mass for that to be true. And, reality is, I think... Britain, first of all, to me, is a more violent country. If you are out on a Friday or Saturday night, certainly in the town that I grew up, the drinking culture is such that when the pubs turn out, someone's going to get whacked.
Right.
But it's just a less lethal country.
I was going to say, it's a lot of fisticuffs.
It's a lot of fighting. And in that sense, America more or less has... pretty much the same as everybody else has got. I don't think Americans are inherently more violent. The parents aren't worse parents. The children aren't worse children. You have segregation, inequality, poverty. Well, so does most of the rest of the Western world. Most of the rest of the Western world has socialized medicine, which does make a difference in terms of mental health provision, mm-hmm. because the primary mental health care provider in America is prisons.
Right.
And that would not be true for most of other Western countries. That notwithstanding, you put that huge pile of tinder exists everywhere. But then in America, you throw the free and commercial availability of... Well, commercial availability of a lethal weapon. Mm-hmm. And that is the kind of combustible element in this mix. So in no other country would this, Western country, would this book be possible.
And to that end, we often hear, especially in light of the more sensationalized mass shootings, well, the answer to this, obviously, is everyone has to have a gun. Mm. The answer to a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And it's almost a personal arms race.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a privatized, individualized... you could go either way with this. You could say the answer to this is no one should have a gun. In writing the book, what I found was... When I asked people the open-ended question, what do you think this is about? You know, your child has been shot or your godson has been shot. What do you think this is about? Nobody mentions guns. It just doesn't come up. And I think it's a bit like traffic. If your child was run over, you're not going to say we have to get rid of traffic. Because it's difficult to imagine a world without traffic for most people.
Right.
And if you were to put up a speed bump or a campaign for a stop sign, no one would say it was unconstitutional. And so they, you know, when you ask them a more leading question, what do you think of guns? Then they say it's crazy. For the most part, it's crazy. You know, you shouldn't be able to get them so easily. Anybody can get them. You know, that's the general thing. And then when you ask them about the gun debate, they're just like, you know, that's not something we're engaged in for the most part.
True enough.
At all, because it's kind of... It feels like people shouting at each other about, you know, a sacred script, that's, you know, the Constitution, Second Amendment, all that kind of stuff. And honestly, in some of the harder areas, the kind of really impoverished areas where people are kind of live, while things like background checks and things like that are, you know, are good, I think, and they would support them. The problem is more in general and more endemic than anything that it's like, look, we need the schools, youth services, and jobs. And, you know, we need a community that's not been completely hollowed out. And mm-hmm. in the absence of those things, for you to reduce this to background checks or whatever, well, that's kind of not really going to fix
sort of the Band-Aid solution.
Yeah.
I want to remind listeners that this is a call-in show, so if you would like to join us on the air, you can go ahead and give us a ring at 503-231-8187. I believe we have Camilo on the line. Good morning, Camilo.
Good morning, and good morning, Gary. I'm very proud to have you on KBOO. I've been familiar with your work since I read Who We Are and Why It Matters. And I think you've been addressing my question implicitly, but I'd like you to address it explicitly. How does your work in that book inform your work on the current one?
It's a good question.
Thanks, Camila.
Who Are We? Is a book about identity and how identity relates to politics and informs our politics and... the limits and potential for, in my view, for identity politics. Here's how, to me, that issues there are related to this book, Another Day in the Death of America, is that it's about empathy, this book, essentially. Or that's, I hope, the central message. And what I call in Who Are We, a kind of, that we have to develop a kind of militant humanism. And that in Another Day in the Death of America, statistically, it's true. Everybody in the book is working class. They're not all poor, but they're all working class. Statistically, if you're wealthy, and particularly if you're wealthy and white, these are unlikely to be your kids, statistically. You may be unlucky, but you would have to be quite unlucky. Mm-hmm. But then when you read their stories, and the book is, I say the book is not about gun control, it's about what happens when you don't have gun control. And it's driven by the stories of these 10 kids, who they were in life, not just how they died. Mm-hmm. Are they actually so different from your kids? Mm-hmm. And are their parents actually so different from your parents, or from parents that you know, mm-hmm. or from you? And so this is not another species of people, which is how they're treated. Mm-hmm. And that there is an assumption that, well, these are not people like us. And so that message in Who Are We, which is we have to develop a militant humanism, I think comes to the fore here, because segregation, both economic and racial and any other kind of segregation, is a real barrier to empathy. And that segregation is made on the basis not of what you do, but who you are.
Excellent. Let's go ahead and talk to Jim. 503-231-8187, the number to call. Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Jim. Apparently Jim has left us.
No, I haven't left you.
Oh, there you are. Excellent. It's our engineering pixie needing to grow longer arms. Thank you. Thank you for being there, Jim, and good morning.
Good morning.
What do you have to add?
There's a lot of information that's being disregarded in discussions of this sort. Many of the, almost all of the shooters and young suicides and mass killers have been medicated with prescription psychiatric drugs, particularly antidepressants and SSRIs, selective serotonin uptake inhibitors. They have terrible side effects. 25 million Americans are on SSRI drugs. If 0.1% react violently to these drugs, that's 25,000 potential mass murderers. Even the government has acknowledged the dangers of SSRI drugs. In 2004, the FDA ordered pharmacies to provide to all parents or guardians for youngsters 18 and under an antidepressant patient medication guide, which stated, in part, call healthcare provider right away if you or your family member has any of the following symptoms: acting aggressive, being angry or violent, and acting on dangerous impulses. Never stop an antidepressant medication without first talking to a healthcare provider. Stopping an antidepressant medicine suddenly can cause other symptoms. Now, these situations are never addressed by the corporate media.
Okay.
Because the pharmaceutical companies spent billions in advertising, and the debate has generally focused on guns and the possession of guns.
All right.
Almost every one of the mass murderers who use guns, and many of the suicides, are the result of side effects of these drugs.
All right, Jim.
I'll stand by for replies.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I mean, none of these stories in this book are mass shootings or suicides, which doesn't necessarily mean that some of these kids or people may not have been medicated, and also the shooters are often not minors themselves. They may be adults. I don't know their medical status, but it doesn't fit that profile. But it does actually speak to the original point that I referred to in terms of socialized medicine, that if the primary provider of mental health care is the prisons, and you don't have socialized medicine, then all sorts of things are possible in terms of pharmaceutical provision and lack of resources.
I think that, well, first of all, I just want to let people know that this is Positively Revolting. You are listening to KABU, your very own community radio station. I'm Ani, and this morning our guest is Gary Young, distinguished journalist and author of several books, the most recent being A Day in the Death of America. Let me get the name right.
Another Day in the Death of America.
And we are talking about gun violence in American culture. 503-231-8187 is the number to join us. And if you also want to follow along Positively Revolting throughout the week on Facebook, you can find our page on Facebook or follow us in the Twitterverse at Positive Revolt. And so let's just go ahead and say good morning to our next caller, Nolan. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Similar to the last caller that called in, isn't this more of a mental health issue as opposed to a gun control issue?
I think it's a good question. I'm going to just go ahead and maybe we can put it this way. There are mental health concerns, and as Gary has pointed out, not having socialized medicine in this country does not help that one iota. And yet, let's look at the numbers of gun violence in America versus the rest of the global North.
Right. I mean, here's the thing. America is not alone or exceptional in people having mental health problems.
Exactly.
In Britain, there are mental health, people have mental health problems too. What they don't have is the easy commercial availability, either legally or illegally, of guns. So whenever people talk about this in some other term, well, it's not guns, it's so-and-so, then you have to ask yourself, well, do other countries have that? And if they do, and they are not even, it's not even like they're not in the same ballpark, they're not even playing the same sport, then clearly it's something else. Now, what I was at pains to say earlier is that what reporting on this book really reveals is that in itself, the piecemeal gun control conversation is inadequate in many of these communities because the issues are broader, far broader and societal, and it goes beyond mental health, frankly, to youth services, schools, jobs, a sense of hope. I mean, a lot of these areas are like places where capitalism just doesn't need people anymore, and they're parked in an area, they're policed like they're in occupied territory. Sometimes the only viable industry for kind of young people is some kind of drug trade. The only place where they're going to get any respect is in a gang, and kind of basic rules of vigilantism and self-preservation. I mean, these are, in many ways, the most American spaces you can imagine in terms of independence, lack of government, social control through the might is right. So it's not just about guns. It's not just about gun control. But the notion that this isn't about guns, it's about mental health. Well, unless that comes with the argument that Americans are more prone to mental health crises than other places in the Western world. That is an inadequate answer.
And just statistically speaking, I did look at a comparative list of gun deaths per 100,000 in the population. And the U.S. is over 10, about 10.5. The U.K. is 0.23, so less than a quarter of 1%, just as a comparison. And again, this is per capita. You know, you can look throughout Europe and see that most countries don't broach 1%. You know, Sweden is up there with, 1.5 compared to the U.S.'s 10.5. It kind of reminds me, the question kind of reminds me of the ubiquitous bumper sticker of the late 70s and 80s. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. Therefore, guns are fine. They're this morally neutral thing that just sort of are there.
Yeah, and I've always found that tautology a bit odd, you know. Toasters don't make toast. People make toast. Well, fine, but that's what toasters exist to do, to make toast.
Thank you.
And guns exist primarily with the aim. I mean, sometimes you can get marksman kind of guns and hunting guns, but they exist to kind of kill things and hurt things. That's the point. And also, they kill people. You know, guns don't kill people. People kill people. Well, even if you accept that, and I just think it's a bit daft, then you then have to engage with the fact that, fine, but people can kill people much easier with a gun than anything else is commercially available. So on the day of Sandy Hook, a man with mental health problems went into an elementary school in China on the same day with a knife. He didn't kill anyone. It's just much harder to kill people with, it's much easier to kill people with guns. And so that doesn't mean necessarily that someone might not come up with an argument for guns, but that's not it. That's actually a cop-out, really.
I agree with most of the stuff you guys are saying. I have to, you know, obviously it makes sense, but I feel like comparing us to a country like Britain or, you know, those other European countries is difficult because Britain lives in a situation where, you know, like you were saying earlier, most of the population doesn't have a gun. They don't have access to them. It's not.
Well, that's sort of the point. That's there. It's the ubiquitous access to guns.
The difference for us, though, is that they're in our society. Most gun crime, most killings aren't done by legal owners of weapons. People don't go to the hardware store or to the sporting goods shop, buy a gun, and then co-commit a mass murder. Most of those are done with guns that are obtained illegally.
So
we're going to attack the gun problem. We're just taking guns out of those good people with guns' hands.
Okay, I want to unpack that a little bit.
That acquire those guns through illegal ways.
I want to unpack that a little bit. You're talking about these mass killings, you know, illegal owners and all that. First of all, most of the folks that have done, like, the sensationalized mass shootings actually have had those guns legally. Second of all, when you're looking at statistics of, you know, gun violence, here's something interesting, and I'd love to hear what Gary has to say about it. In looking at mass shootings and how we break that down and how we define it, by most definitions, say the FBI and federal definitions, it would be any shooting in which four or more people are killed.
Or injured.
And then then you start looking at other breakdowns, and some people are saying, well, yeah, but you have to exempt domestic violence. You have to exempt gang-related violence. It's more like these stranger danger sort of situations, because if the person knew them, then that doesn't count somehow. And yet, at the same time, we hear stories where somebody's ex goes in and kills the new partner, their ex-spouse, and their four kids, all in a go. But that's not considered a mass shooting by a lot of definitions. Those folks tend to have those guns legally, right? So I'm having a hard time with justifying reality with a meme that is put out there so often in our media.
I mean, the point, in a sense, you made the point yourself when you said, well, those countries don't have guns. That's my point, actually, because you started the conversation by talking about mental health, I think. But those countries don't have guns. And it is possible to be in countries that had a lot of guns and then decided to get rid of them. And this is one of those things where it becomes intriguing to me as a foreigner here, who's lived here for a while, that there is a way in which America prides itself on its can-do, apart from this. This is what we can't do now, you know. And look at South Africa, which was in a war, still a very violent country, but has actually managed to reduce the kind of the prevalence of kind of, you know, firearms as a social thing. And there was a civil war there relatively recently. Australia, there was a mass shooting in Tasmania. They have a buyback. And so I think if you can elect a black president and you can nominate Donald Trump as a Republican candidate, you can do anything if you put your mind to it. And if you don't want to do it, then own it. That's fine. If you think, actually, this is not something that I want to do, this is not something that I support, then own it, and we can talk about that, as opposed to, well, how, you know, that's never going to happen, or the bad guys. Because every person who has a gun is a good guy with a gun until they become a bad guy. And by that time, it's just too late, isn't it? And then, you know, you just have to... you then, though, have to engage with the collateral damage. That if you're not going to do anything about this, then 7 kids are going to die every day. Might go up, might go down. But you read the stories of these kids in this book, not kids not so different from you, and they fall in barrios in Houston and in suburbs and rural areas and low-income urban areas, sleepovers, stairwells, street corners. The youngest is 9, the oldest is 19. Then you have to engage with that. Because if you're going to say, well, we're not going to do anything about this, or it's too difficult, or but it's the criminals, or there's some way of you arguing not to do anything, then how do you engage with these kind of statistics?
And I think the statistics is half the problem, because again, numbers, we can numb out to numbers. But when you start talking about their stories and their lives of the people that have been lost, the average of 7 kids a day, but then the average of more than 80 adults a day as well, that we have, one of the stories that strikes me as so very American and so very typical was the story that you were telling of the kid that was killed at a sleepover because kids got a hold of loaded guns that were in the house.
Yeah, so...
Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, Tyler Dunn, he's 11. and his kind of upbringing in this rural Michigan is kind of like Mark Twain with a cell phone, really. You know, he's trapping critters and fishing down by the creek and, you know, and then playing Call of Duty, you know, whenever he gets a chance. And he goes to sleep over at his friend's place, who we'll call Brandon. He's what they usually do in these when he goes to Brandon's, or what they sometimes do, is Brandon's dad Jerry would take them trucking. He was a trucker, and then they would play video games on the way, help him unload. He'd give him $20, which is a kind of, you know, night out, and that's what they're supposed to do on this day, because all of the shootings take place in a 24-hour period, and so they're supposed to be doing that. And then the boys say, you know, we'd rather stay home and play Call of Duty. And Jerry says, you know, have at it. And he leaves them at home with some money for a pizza. And unwittingly, a few loaded guns. And the boys, Brandon is showing Tyler the gun. Brandon leaves him with it, goes to get a milkshake. His story is Tyler's giving him the gun back. The trigger catches on his shorts pocket and shoots Tyler in the head. Now, I mean, there is a place you can go with that where you say, you know, if they'd had gun safety classes, you know, none of this would have happened. But, you know, gun safety, kids have classes in, you know, traffic awareness.
I was going to say bike and traffic safety come to mind.
Yeah, and the reality is if you leave a lethal weapon in the hands of a child, there is a chance that they might use it inappropriately. You know, I have two kids, and one of the phrases I use most often in my home life is, what could possibly go wrong? You know, they're kind of balancing on a kind of glass table, or they're kind of, you know, doing something weird with a knife. I mean, kids are kids. And right.
You kind of want to wrap them in bubble wrap and just sort of keep them safer. But that's, you know, impossible. And impractical.
Yeah. Sometimes you want to wrap them in bubble wrap and chuck them against the wall a little bit. Watch them bounce. But
just now and again.
But there are all sorts of places one can go with this in order to avoid the point. Which is that unless you think American kids are more irresponsible, more careless, more stupid, more violent, then there is one thing that America has in this story that nobody else has, and only one thing, and that's the gun. And as I've kind of emphasized a few times, I think that in terms of understanding gun control and what a gun control narrative would be, that story has to be more all-encompassing and deal with a series of societal absences, really, and collective absences. And one of the powers, I think, of looking at children and teens is, and I take this on in the book, personal responsibility. I'm very much keen on personal responsibility. It would be a very difficult world if people just could say, it's not me, it's society, it's my culture, it's slavery or homophobia, or so you can't blame me for what I do. We can't have that world. But then if there's personal responsibility, and this is particularly obvious with children, I think it's true generally, there's also collective responsibility for the kind of society that we want to live in and the society that we choose to create. Now, not all of these kids are, stellar lives. So one of them, Tashawn Anderson, is a gang member in Chicago. His godmother says, Tashawn has killed people. I know he's killed people. If I'd picked a different day, I might have been writing about someone that Tashawn had killed. Now, I've no more desire to meet someone with that profile on a dark night than anybody else. But Tashawn is 18, and we have to ask ourselves, well, how did an 18-year-old get there? Because societally, we do have to kind of talk, and it's just insufficient to say parents.
Mm.
Because, there's a range of abilities and capacities in parenting. America is not unique in having parents that, you know, struggle as opposed to don't. What's unique is in it producing characters like Tashawn, whose Facebook page is like an online graveyard, and now he's part of that cemetery. So I think, you know, I don't dodge the personal responsibility question at all, but it's meaningless unless it's connected to the collective responsibility one.
And earlier you had said that that oftentimes we hear these stories of violence coming from communities that capitalism has finished with, that capitalism has no good for.
Yeah, I mean, there's one of the boys, actually the boy who is shot dead not long after Tashawn, is in Newark. And that's, of all the census tract, which is the kind of smallest area that the census will measure, smaller than a zip code. This is the poorest place by quite a long way that anybody dies. And he, Gary Anderson, is walking back with his girlfriend. He's wearing a red hoodie. He's got plaits. And there's a drug turf warfare, and they're looking for a kid with a red hoodie and plaids. It's not Gary Anderson, but they don't know that, and they shoot him as he's coming back into his mum's complex. Mm. Next to that housing complex, there is a housing complex that is completely bricked up. And next door to the to Gary Anderson's dad's house, which is where his dad raised him mostly, is a factory that is bricked up, that Gary Anderson's granny used to work in, a cosmetics factory. And it's bricked up and there's trees growing out of it and, you know, birds in it and so on. And Newark is a kind of one of those post-industrial landscapes. The money went to places where labor is cheaper and unions are weaker, regulations are looser. And it left a bunch of people behind. And with no tax base, with no jobs. And then, you know, so in response to the question, well, you know, where do all these drugs come from and why are they? Well, you know, it's one of the few thriving industries in those areas, and it actually can't be sustained only by people living in those areas. People have to be coming in to buy them because the people in those areas are broke. And and once again, in terms of entrepreneurialism, vigilantism, independence, I mean, the one thing you can't say about kids working in the drug industry is that they are lazy people, or that they are that they're looking for a handout. They're you know, in a bizarre and gruesome way, they're living a dream, and it's a short life for most of them, and it's certainly not my dream. But given the hand that these people are dealt, if you took a group of wealthy white kids and you dumped them in an area where schools were like prison, there was no social provision, there was no youth services, no one to ferry them about to kind of different sporting things where you're kind of... after school activities where you're kind of the landscape of where you lived looked completely trashed. And then see how they turned out. Mm. I don't think it's going to be any different, which actually, in a way, swings back to the question about how this relates to the themes in Who Are We? That this is a kind of, you know, there is nothing inherent in these communities or these people that make this so. This is a societal thing.
We have Tim on the line. Good morning, Tim. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Seems to me there's a lot of support for at least some forms of stricter gun laws, whether it's magazine capacities, but nothing seems to get done with the political clout of the NRA. And I know there are a few organizations out there that are on the other side of the issue that are working, but how do you have an organization form that would have the political clout of the NRA on the other side of the issue?
That's a really good question. And I'd say two things, which are kind of critiques of where the gun control movement is at. And the first is that it doesn't have roots in these hard-to-reach communities, and therefore it doesn't have the urgency. The people living at the sharp end of this gun violence are more likely to be talked about in the gun control movement than be talked to. That the gun control movement as such is fairly suburban in its appeal. You know, be aware that these urban ills are coming your way, and it has this sense of this is a scary world, and the scary world they're talking about is the one in which these people live. You know, it also limits the conversation to these smaller things and doesn't engage in the broader thing. So it talks, and it's a gun control movement, I get that. It's not a kind of broader transformational thing. It's a specific one issue thing. But for the people at the sharp end of this who would make it urgent and who would make it a priority, it's not just one thing. The guns are related to the poverty and the destitution and the poor schools and the lack of youth provision. So there's that. But then there's also that the gun rights movement has a narrative that goes beyond background checks or not background checks or smart guns or not smart. They talk about, when I've been to a couple of NRA conventions, and one of the boys, Kenneth Mills Tucker, who shot in Indianapolis, 5 months later, the NRA convention is in Indianapolis. Mm. And so I go to this convention. And you say to them, I don't get it. And I usually evoke my Britishness and I say, I don't get it. You know, what is it? And they, to a person, they say, are you married? Yes. Do you have children? Yes. And then they're off to the races. Imagine someone breaks into your house. They're going to rape your wife. They're going to kill your kids. What are you going to do? You're going to wait and call the police? Are you going to, what? He's got a gun. You're going to box him? What, you know, what are you thinking? And it's an appeal to masculinity, to vigilantism, to homestead, to, it's a kind of anti-government thing that, like, you don't wait for the government to do that. It's a very, actually a very American appeal. And the gun control movement doesn't have a counter narrative to that that taps into something else that America can be, which is, you know, hopeful and can do. And I mean, there's a range of things that America is, that has nothing to do with that. And so
it's that whole John Wayne, the face of John Wayne on the Second Amendment.
Yeah. And so long as the gun control movement limits itself to the smaller issues of background checks and this and that and the other, it may win a couple of battles, but it's never going to win the war, I don't think, because, and this is where the fact that it's not a broader transformational thing becomes a problem, because it, for the gun, and this is partly what I'm hearing when people are saying, well, it's the criminals and bad guys, you know, a world of good guys and bad guys. Come on. I mean, what world is that? There's good in everyone and there's bad in everyone. And, you know, I don't want to get all kumbaya about it here, but I mean, it's, there's no analysis of how the world works if we are reduced to good guys and bad guys. And being a criminal,
it's a great narrative for comic books.
Well, right.
But it's not particularly useful in society. No.
And being a criminal in a country where some communities are routinely criminalized is itself not just a useful category for determining. I mean, look at these areas where the cops are shooting people dead, clearly, unarmed. They're not criminals yet. I mean, what they're doing is criminal, certainly morally, often. But and the people that they're shooting, they may have a criminal record. They may not have a criminal record, but they're being executed in plain sight. So good guys, bad guys doesn't really work. But there does need to be some broader understanding of what America is about and for, in which gun control can be kind of embedded.
And with that, we are just about out of show. We have just a moment left. We have been talking with Gary Young. He is the author, a distinguished columnist and journalist, author of several books, including Another Day in the Death of America, A Chronicle of 10 Short Lives, which is recently published from Nation Books. Final word, Gary.
I guess if you were to take anything from this book, it would be, are these kids so different? Are these kids so different from you and people you know? Are these parents so different from you or people that you know? This is not another species that this is happening to. These are human beings, young human beings. And I think that a country that can tolerate 7 children being shot dead every day has reached a kind of morally intolerable threshold.
Well put. Morally intolerable threshold it is, and that's where we are. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm Ani. Thank you, Teresa, my silent partner, Sankar, to back me up, as my regular co-host, Lynn, is in recovering from a pretty serious illness. So thank you all for joining us this week, and we will be back with you next week when I will be interviewing Starhawk. So stay tuned for the incomparable Radio Zine.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Full Gallop, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs through Saturday, October 8th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Full Gallop is a portrait of Diana Vreeland, who stood at the center of American style for 5 decades. As editor of Harper's Bazaar and Vogue magazines and as a member of the International Cafe Society, she chronicled the extraordinary people and events of her time. This play is a portrait of Vreeland at a turning point in her life. Again, that's Full Gallop, now through October 8th.